Welcome to this Wednesday morning's talk on the 9-day retreat, November 2008. And so far during this retreat we've had some relaxation, taking it easy, starting to build up some momentum, I hope. And I did promise last night, after one of the questions, to talk a little bit about nimittas and jhanas on this morning talk. And those of you who think, wow, that's way beyond me, I might as well go back to bed during this 8 o'clock session, don't ever think like that. Because, again, I've been teaching these things for a long time now. And it does happen that sometimes a person, as we say, like flukes a jhana, and they get very, very deep. And it's very important for them to know what's happening and why it's happening and where all this experiences fit into the scheme of meditation. And it's also the fact that jhanas are out there, you know they exist, and they talk about them a lot, and anyone who reads the Buddha's teachings, you hear about jhanas almost every second or third page. So it's important actually not to ignore them, but also to understand what they are, how they arrive, and what's really important for me as a teacher. So, you know, what happens and what to do, or rather what not to do when you get close to these things, and how to make use of those amazing experiences to get some really nice, beautiful insights into the nature of your body and the nature of your mind. So today we're going to sort of talk a little bit about nimittas and jhanas. But first of all, I know that when I first started talking about these things, it was a very dangerous thing to talk about, simply because when you start talking about these amazing experiences, you know, bliss better than sex, and getting insights which are going to make you enlightened, everyone says, I want, I want, I want. And because I hear about these things, and other people get them, yeah, I'm going to get jhanas this retreat. But I've taught enough for the last 3 or 4 days about learning how to let things go, not desire, not wanting things. And by establishing sort of that sort of foundation of letting go, relaxing, not wanting, not craving, being content, open the door of your heart for this moment, whatever it is, being happy to be here, this is good enough. By establishing those teachings in the very beginning, hopefully you won't get drawn into wanting and desiring these amazing experiences. And I'm very strong on this about how to get the jhanas is you really have to let go, do nothing. In fact, I'm getting so well known for this teaching of just doing nothing that somebody actually found on the internet, you know, one of the how many people screw in a light bulb joke. And apparently this, in the internet, this, how many Ajahn Brahms does it take to screw in a light bulb? And the answer is none, you do nothing and it screws itself in. So, you know, I don't know who put that on the internet. But it's very true, you know, the idea of doing nothing and everything happens by itself. Okay, it's true. This light bulb won't screw itself in if you don't do anything. But jhanas happen when you don't do anything. So please keep that in mind. So that when I'm talking about the jhanas, you don't get this craving and desire and thinking, right, I'm going to really go for it this retreat. Because if you do, you're just stuffing yourself up and you're not going to be getting any peace or anything at all. Because all these nimittas and jhanas, they are stages of letting go. The more you let go, the more still you are, the increasing your chances of achieving these experiences. But the more you want, the more you crave, the more you strive, it's becoming more and more difficult. These are stages of incredibly deep stillness. And by talking about stillness, it makes it very clear that if you do something, if you strive, you're agitating the mind, you're taking yourself further away from these experiences, not getting closer. So your job is just to be really as still as you can, to wait, be kind, be gentle, make peace until the peace gets so strong that it begets sublime peace, and this is where we get these great experiences. Another way of looking at it, which is a lovely way of looking at it, the states of letting go. So actually, what are you letting go of? And of course, you're letting go. Excuse me. You're letting go of time, first of all. So you're not worried about past or future, and certainly you're not worried about the next moment. So you really have to be right in the center of the present moment, just right now, until all this idea of what you're doing next and where you've come from completely disappears. And of course this is what hopefully you've been training at for the last few days. Even when you're having your breakfast, you know, one piece of toast at a time. You don't sort of take off the other piece of toast. No waiting in turn. Always in the moment, one thing at a time, not worrying about what's coming next, not worrying about what's gone before. So the same as in a retreat. How many days have gone? How many days are left? Who cares? So we're not really worried about sort of the time. We're just concerned that this present moment is the only time we have. So we let go of time, and then we let go of this inner speech, which is always disturbing us and telling us what to do. Like the simile last night of the taxi driver, which I gave. If you're always telling the taxi driver how to drive their car, how to drive their taxi, they'll throw you out, they'll get very upset at you. So your job is just to be this silent passenger of the meditation. You just sit there, and you don't interrupt the process with all these words and all these comments. And then you let go. The next thing is the most important, you let go of your body. And it's one of the reasons why we can't even get to nimitta stages is because we're unable to let go of our body. Even if it's painful, we still can't let it go. We are literally attached to our body, big time. If you weren't attached to your body, it'd be very easy to meditate and let all these things go and get into at least the nimitta stage. So really the barrier to getting the nimittas, these lights which come in the mind, is you're overly concerned about your body. It's a weird thing, but I've already mentioned sounds. Even though it's the sound of somebody talking outside, it's got nothing to do with you, it's not your business. But how hard it is for us to sort of let sound go. Even the feelings in the body, the pains, they're driving you crazy. Why can't you just let them go and detach and disassociate from them? Think, well, you know, maybe the happy pain, the happy experiences, I can keep those and just let go of the painful ones. But you can't do that. One of the reasons is because we don't really know. Just that little mechanism of how to let go of the attachment to the body. Even if the body is painful, we still want to be with it. I've seen this several times, visiting people who are sick in hospital, on the edge of death. And even though their body is very, very painful, and they know they're going to die soon, still they struggle for life. They'd rather have life with pain than have death without pain. Because the death to them is very uncertain, unknown, the mysterious. And so they think they're going to disappear, at least with pain, they're existing. Little by little we have to learn how to sort of let go of this body and allow it to fade away and vanish. You're going to have to do that when you die anyway. That's why we have these nice little mantras. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. Please try that, because it's a great mantra to do when you're walking or when you're sitting or even when you're eating your lunch. I will die, that's for sure. If I keep on eating, it'll be very quickly. So whatever it is, I will die, that's for sure. What that does, it puts this body in context. It is just a vehicle for you. And it doesn't matter whether it's a great vehicle, or a small vehicle, a beautiful vehicle, an ugly vehicle, a young or an old vehicle, all vehicles, you have to let them go in the end. And if you can learn how to let them go now, that's a wonderful thing to do. So little by little, how do we let go of the body? We sit still. Because you notice that the way that our senses work, they can only notice things which change. Now when you first close your eyes, the first thing you notice, if you're mindful enough, is blackness. Just the inside of the eyelid. But because blackness doesn't change, after a few seconds, you don't even notice the blackness anymore. The sense of sight actually turns off. It's gone. You're not seeing, you're not seeing, it's just, you're not seeing anything, it's just gone. The sense of sight. Smell and taste are very easy to turn off. They're not a very strong sense base. But But of course, you know, if there's a change of smell, or if you put some food in the mouth, it turns everything on, and you're aware of that. Even right now, you have the taste of your saliva in your mouth. But because that doesn't change, after a while, the sense of taste turns off. And the sense of smell turns off as well. Because there's nothing to smell, there's nothing changing. The hard things to turn off is the sense of physical touch and the sense of hearing. Those are the two most difficult ones to turn off. But the first thing which turns off is your bodily sensations. The sound is the last one. That's the most sensitive of your five senses. And that's why we have alarm clocks to wake us up in the morning. Bells to take us out of meditation. Because the sound is something which is penetrates the mind more than any other of the senses. So we have to let go of the physical sensations first of all. And when we let go of the physical sensations is to sit in a comfortable posture. And that's one of the reasons why, that if you do have an ache or a pain during the meditation, and you, by moving, you can lessen it, please do so. It's very important. It's not indulging, but that actually allowing the body to let go of the physical feelings. So you sit comfortably, you sit still, with as minimum pain as possible, and then after a while you notice your body disappears. Your hands disappear, your legs disappear, you don't know what they're doing. Until the only part of your body left is the breathing. I call the breathing like a stepping stone. So it's very hard to let go of all physical feelings all in one hit, although sometimes you can do that. But if you just focus on the breath, everything else in the body disappears. You've just got your breath, and after a while then the breath disappears. The whole physical feeling goes, and with it the body. The experiences I had as a young monk, you know, you had to learn how to let go of the physical feelings in the body. Because remember that in the first weeks I was in Thailand, you know, going and staying with Ajahn Chah, and just after about a month staying in Wat Bonpong, his monastery, we opened up Wat Bananachar, the monastery for the Western monks. So when you went there, when I went there first of all, there were no huts, there was no kitchen, there was no toilets, it was just a forest, so we just slept in our mosquito nets on the ground. And you would go to sleep at night just watching the snakes slither past you, just about 6 inches between you and the snake's mouth. So, but you know, it was interesting. I didn't mind the snakes. What I really detested were the mosquitoes. Because there were heaps and hundreds, it was a jungle. And Ajahn Chah would come every evening, you know, about sort of 5 or 6 o'clock, and then we'd do some chanting, and then we'd meditate for an hour, just at dusk, just when all the mosquitoes would come out. It was the worst possible time of the day to meditate. And there was no buildings, it was outside under the trees. And those mosquitoes were ravenous. I mentioned this joke to you before, but remember, number one, look how much exposed skin like a monk has. Bare shoulder, bald head. We've got much more seats at the dining table than you have. So you can get more mosquitoes on there. Number two, this was the first time in that area ever that the mosquitoes had Western food. See, you know what it's like when you get a new cuisine in town. Everybody wants to try it out, just to see. After a while, it's just normal, and they just don't come. And I'm sure those mosquitoes told all their friends, hey, there's Western monks around. Come and have a taste of these guys. And the worst thing, though, because Ajahn Chah was there, maybe sit for at least an hour, sometimes 2 hours, and he would sit perfectly still. And you would try and sit still then, have all these mosquitoes all over you. And there was no mosquito repellent. There was no sort of mosquito coils. You were out there in the open, and it was a free dinner, free lunch. That's the other thing. The mosquitoes knew that monks can't swat them. So they knew it was a safe dinner, so they can just go for it. So they had all these mosquitoes on you, and this is no exaggeration. With a fellow monk, we know he was an American, just ordained just slightly later than me, so we sat next to each other, and we just play a game of counting the mosquitoes on your arm. And you would get to about 60 or 70, And then you actually couldn't count anymore because they literally were too close together. You know, you couldn't distinguish them to resolve, you know, two mosquitoes. Because that was incredibly irritating, as you can imagine. And very often, the first few times you did this, you open your eyes and just, you know, thinking that everyone else must be suffering. But Ajahn Chah and all these Thai people were sitting perfectly still. And it just really pissed me off. At least if they were moving, I could sort of run away. But, you know, they were all sitting absolutely still, so I thought I had to sit still too and just endure. And afterwards, you were covered with bumps, you know, on your arm, because, you know, for Westerners, when you get bitten by a mosquito, it is a little welt on your hand or your arm or your skin. But then eventually I thought the only way I could survive was actually to really focusing on my breath and letting go of my body. And you know, after a little while you could do that quite successfully. Maybe you did it because you had to, because the alternative was too irritating. And it was a wonderful experience. Every evening I even look forward to it. Because, you know, the mosquitoes, they make sure you didn't wander off anywhere. Because any wandering off into this thought or that fantasy, and you just feel your skin again. So I just focused on the breath, and soon my whole body disappeared. And I got some wonderful meditations those evenings. Simply because the body vanished. You let go of all those physical feelings, because it was just too irritating. And I can't really call it painful, because mosquito bites aren't painful. They're just really, really hard to bear. So that's actually how I learned how to start letting go of my body. And it's wonderful when you're free of your body. When you become free of your body, it's like your physical sense of touch is gone. Still hear the sound, but after a while you keep things reasonably, in a reasonably silent place. Or at least, it doesn't have to be silent. You have some sound of the trucks or the cars or the aircraft in the distance. As long as it doesn't change too much, you can soon not hear it. And turning off the sense of sound is not that hard for people to do. They do it very regularly. And I told this, I think, to when I was talking in a Sri Lankan temple, sort of in Toronto. And I said, look, your husbands have been watching the cricket and you go and tell them, darling, the dinner's ready. They just cannot hear you. It's not as they're ignoring you, it just doesn't actually reach the brain. Because actually sometimes when we don't pay attention, it just all disappears. And so what we're doing, we're letting go of all those five senses and with it the body by focusing on something like the breath and then allowing the breath to settle down and disappear. I know why the breath settles down and disappears, because after a while it's just breath going in, breath going out. After a while it just becomes breath. We don't really perceive it's going in or going out, it's just breath. It becomes so even, hardly ever changing, that it just turns off. Because things which don't change vanish from our perception. And everything becomes still. So through stillness, when things don't move, many things vanish. And so we meditate, whether it's loving-kindness, watching the breath or whatever, we meditate first of all to allow these five senses to disappear and with it the body to go. When that happens, of course, what happens next is nimitta appears to you. Because the nimitta, as I mentioned before, is how we perceive the sixth sense, the mind. It's just how it appears to us. Again, I did mention that for some people, but it's a very, very small minority, sometimes they experience the mind just as a feeling. When I say a feeling, a very, very pleasurable experience, it's not felt with your body, it's felt with the mind. In the same way the nimitta, what you actually experience when the body disappears, is not seen with your eyes. The eyes aren't working anymore, they're turned off. It is a mental experience, just experienced through the sixth sense of the mind. But what happens is, we just do not have the language to understand mental objects like this. And so the way that we use the faculty of perception, we try and find in our data bank of experience, in our memory, some other experience from our ordinary life which is similar to the experience we have now when we have a nimitta in front of us. And for most people, the experience which is most close is a simile of a bright light. A very strong moon, a headlight, a flashlight. You haven't got a flashlight in front of your eyes. You're not seeing the moon. But that's the closest you have. And so you describe it as a brilliant light. Those people who have these nimittas, sometimes they're purple nimittas, blue nimittas, yellow nimittas, green nimittas. They know what people are like. Sometimes they want to find out, why do I have a green one while she has a purple one? Is it because, you know, she's higher than me or whatever? And it really does not matter at all what colour it is, because one of the amazing insights, you know, because I've been meditating a long time, and this is my almost like my speciality in meditation, you know that everyone actually sees exactly the same thing. And actually we add the colour. We perceive it as purple, as white, as yellow, but exactly the same experience. So it doesn't really matter what colour you actually think it is. To you it actually appears like purple. But a very common feature of a real nimitta is it's a purple which is you cannot see in the real world. It's deeper, richer, more brilliant. That's a common feature. But it's, you say it's a purple, it's not a purple, it's the same as everyone else sees. You actually add that description onto the experience. But that doesn't matter, that's how it appears to you, and that's how you would describe it. When these nimittas come up, remember, it's the body has disappeared, no five senses anymore, and just this nimitta comes up. Of course, if the nimitta comes up too quickly, you can still hear, maybe feel in your body, which means the whole thing is pretty unstable. However, if you just go through the process very carefully, now watching the breathing especially is a wonderful way of getting these nimittas, because it is a stepping stone. You let go of every other part of your five senses, you just got the feeling of the breath, and after a while, when the breath disappears, the other five senses have already turned off, and now just that last part of the fifth sense, the physical touch, also turns off, and now you've got this beautiful pure nimitta with no sound, no feeling left. That's why the meditation on the breath is perhaps one of the best. It's one which was used by the Buddha and one which was taught by most of the monks and nuns who teach meditation, because it actually gets you on very pure nimitta without being having a few sounds or feelings interfering with it. So when you get that pure nimitta coming up, no sounds, no feelings in the body, just this beautiful mind sense, all you need to do is to try and keep it still, to see what you can do to make this nimitta not move. Of course, those of you who have had nimitta experiences already, big ones or ordinary ones, or somewhere in between, you know that the two main enemies of those nimitta states are excitement and fear. The fear comes up because, you know, you're going to a new place, you haven't experienced before, and you can't feel your body. Remember this lady in Singapore once, she was just getting into the beginnings of meditation, she was watching her breath and her hands disappeared. Ah! I can't feel my hands anymore. And she was very scared. And I said, look, that's nothing, lady, wait till your whole body disappears. But, you know, because I said it was going to be very beautiful and nice, so she carried on meditating. But we do get afraid when our body disappears. Why do we get afraid? It shows that we're attached to our body. However, don't have to worry too much, because you don't abandon that attachment just by thinking about it and working it all out. It's not my body, I'm going to die, so what? It's usually actually the experiences when you have these nimittas and you realize the body has disappeared and it's fine. It's actually, it's really nice. It's bloody nice, to use an English word. It's wonderful. So that actually, the experience overcomes the fear. What was I afraid of? It's lovely when I let go of my body. So the fear and the attachment, sometimes the attachments can only really be overcome when we sort of trick you into letting go. So that which you're attached to is just taken away from you for a few moments, and you realize it's really nice not having these things. So when you go back into your body afterwards, you realize, well, why be attached? And when I let go of these things, it's beautiful, it's nice. It's very similar to those people who are fortunate enough to have some sort of trauma and have out-of-the-body experiences. And they die for a few minutes and they go floating off outside. And when they realize it's such a nice thing to die. You go floating out your body without sort of having this body to worry about. And when you come back afterwards, the majority of people have out-of-the-body experiences or near-death experiences, they're called. They're not afraid of death anymore. Because they know they've been there, they've done that, they remember it, and they realize it's actually a very beautiful experience. In fact, having this body is the pain, which is why when people really understand, sort of when you get born, that's the saddest thing. Every time you witness the birth of your first child, you should be crying, oh, the poor thing. He's got all this suffering in front of it, having a body and getting sick and getting an itchy nose like I've got this morning. But when they die, they say, hey, they're free of the body, well done. You'd have a celebration. The Irish have got it right when they have a wake, when they sort of, when somebody dies. And I've said this to Nola Mara. If you actually look, when somebody is born, they start crying. The baby knows what's going on. But when they die, I've been to so many funerals, they're smiling in their coffin. Ah, free at last. Yeah, that's really only a joke, because I know there's undertakers. Actually, because you're a monk here, you actually go and see people being embalmed. And they show you what actually what happens. Then they put all these chemicals in you, and before the actual body sets, they make sure they push the mouth up. And I've had a few people, actually, I think, who was that? I forget, some time ago. The wife actually complained, because it's always done that the funeral directors in embalmers always put a smile on the dead person's face. And I think his wife really complained, said he never smiled in his life. That's not him. So they got it wrong. They should have checked that with the wife, first of all, before they did that. But they had the best intentions. But anyway, that's just the fantasy of death caused by the funeral directors. But the point of the matter is that people who experience that, personal experience of death, always say it's very beautiful. And the same anyone who's got sort of nematurs and the body's completely disappeared, it's a wonderful experience. So having that experience lessens your attachment to this physical body. When you know what it's like to let go of the body, and you know what it's like to have a body, and you compare the two, gee, I'm going to ditch my body as soon as I can. So it means that you understand you can be detached to your body. So even just getting a nimitta experience where the five senses and the body disappears, there you are practicing non-attachment to the body. You're not thinking about it. It's not an analysis or an intellectual exercise. Through the very experience of that, you're loosening one of the great attachments which stop us being enlightened, which stop us being free, the attachment to your own body. Which means that people who do these meditations a lot, they're not afraid of death anymore. Even one little reflection which you have when you do these nimittas. When a person dies, and they have, again, near-death experience, and they come back, and you've all heard them tell what happens, floating out of their body, feeling very peaceful and nice. And what happens next? Going towards the light. And I think that those of you who heard me teach before know this, but those who haven't, I think you should see the connection there. The light and the nimitta are exactly the same thing. The nimitta which you see in your meditation is almost exactly the same as what you will see when you die and you go towards the light. Because death, what is death? Letting go of the body, the five senses vanishing. First of all, when you have this mind-made body, when you leave your body at death, you've still got some remnant of the senses there. That's why you can see and hear and even feel a sense of physical pressure. When you go towards the light, exactly the same experience as when you are meditating and see this beautiful light come in your mind of the nimitta. Because that light happens when the five senses disappear. The Buddha described it like the moon released from the clouds. The clouds are like your five senses, covering up this beautiful mind. So when you let go of the body and the five senses, you settle down, which is the job of meditation, and the first thing you see is this beautiful, beautiful mind. When those nimittas first come up, because I'm explaining it like this, It means you'll have less fear. You say, oh, this is what Ajahn Brahm was talking about. You'll understand where it all fits in. So you won't disturb the experience with doubt or with fear or with these other things which stop you enjoying something very, very useful. Huge insights, huge peace, huge pleasure. Why not? So when the nimitta actually does come up for the first time, people, they can experience fear. Or the other one is excitement. This is powerful, this is wonderful, this is actually almost like a spiritual prize you're experiencing. And of course we always get excited, you know, when our football team wins, or when we sort of win the lotto. And if you get excited when you win the lottery, this is far better than winning any lottery. Now, winning any lottery doesn't last very long, but these experiences, you remember them for lifetimes. Which is actually why sometimes people can get back to them in this life very easily, or just spontaneously, because they've experienced it before. Not this lifetime, but before. So when these nimittas actually come up, they have a huge imprint on the mind. And not only that, if you do get too excited, they'll just fade away again too quickly. So this excitement, the fear is an easier obstacle to overcome, just by me talking about it, by sucking you up. There's nothing to be afraid of. The bliss is very, very nice. Fear is an easier obstacle to overcome, but the excitement is the difficult one to overcome. It's the excitement which usually makes the nimitta disappear again, very quickly. Basically, you were very, very still and calm, and the excitement just, the whole thing falls apart again. I remember, telling a little anecdote. When I was a kid, we used to make this house of cards, you know, playing cards. You know, you put two cards together, another two cards together, put a card on top, and build like this pyramid structure. And the higher you got, so the more careful you had to be, because it was very, very unstable. And even if you breathe too hard, the whole thing would fall down. And that's almost like the nimitta stage. It's very, very still, very, very sensitive, and just the slightest of movement will make it all disappear at the very beginning. So your job is actually to try and be as still as possible. And you can't beat the simile, which I think already mentioned, of the still forest pool. Ajahn Chah staying in the evening by a pond or by a lake, having washed, having drunk water, maybe washed some clothes. He would sit maybe 20 meters away from the edge of the pond, and at dusk he would watch the animals come out to drink and play. But they would only come out when they didn't realize he was watching, because they were so afraid that he could be a hunter and would kill them, because that's the only human beings they usually met, hunters. So they didn't know that Ajahn Chah wasn't a hunter, so if he moved, then they would realize there was a human being there and run away from fear, and they would never be able to watch them drink and play by the still forest pool. He said sometimes he was so quiet and so still, and not just the ordinary animals came out, but these very rare, incredibly beautiful animals, which he never realized existed. He said his parents and teachers never told him about these animals. And they would come out to play, only when he was very still. And that was how Ajahn Chah described the nimittas and the jhanas. These are the amazing, beautiful animals, which very few people know exist. And they come out to play by the still forest pool that is your mind. Only when it's very still will they come out to play. Because they think that somebody's watching, they'll run away again. And sometimes not come out again for weeks. So understanding that, I remember I've used that simile before. When the nimitta comes up, I almost like imagine myself, I'm an Ajahn Chah, absolutely motionless, like a statue. And just my mind being motionless as well, not getting excited, not getting afraid, not moving, not trying to take a photo. I must remember to tell Ajahn Brahm about this afterwards, or tell all my friends. Keep me absolutely still and not moving. And then you find the nimittas actually come out and they play, they stay for a long time. For many of you, this is, have got some nimittas coming up, this is one of the hardest trainings to be able to maintain that nimitta. And again, it's always because you can't interfere with it. You really do have to be the passenger. Going back to yesterday's simile of Buddha Air, when the flight attendant comes and offers you a nimitta, you know, you have to sit absolutely still. If you go and grab it from her, she'll go away. You know, if you say, I don't want a yellow one, I want a purple one, they will go away, they won't come back again. And please never ever press the flight attendant's button to try and call her for an emitter. They will never come then. I mean, now I did that once. When I went to Thailand to become a monk from England, that was 34, 35 years ago. Only a poor student, so the cheapest air flight from London to Thailand was via Moscow on Aeroflot. That was the Soviet Airlines. And I still remember to this day, flying from London to Moscow is about 6 hours or something. And halfway on the journey, I was thirsty, they hadn't come in, offered you anything yet. So I saw the flight attendant going past and asked for a cup of tea. That's a simple thing to ask, just a cup of tea. But those flight attendants on Aeroflot, I'm pretty sure they were ex-Soviet weightlifters, all women. They were huge. Now, not like sort of Singapore Airlines, all young girls. A huge lady. And she, it's just a simple request, can I have a cup of tea. She turned around to me and glared and said, "Nyet!" She shouted at me, "Nyet means no." I never asked for anything again. I just sat down there. I was too scared. I thought she'd turn me into the KGB when we reached Moscow for asking for a cup of tea. I couldn't believe that. It took about lack of service. There was actually no service there at all. You never asked for anything. I don't know what they were doing on the flight. But anyway, so with nimitters coming up, you just allow them to come. But you don't do anything with them. You find when you don't interfere, when you don't control, that's when they stay. So what you have to do here, what you're learning here, you've already let go of the body. Now you have to really learn how to let go of the last bit of controlling. The little interfering which you do. So I mentioned someone on a retreat. Yeah, they don't drive the car, but they're backseat drivers. Because I remember going to London the last time, being picked up by the airport by one of the disciples there. And she had her son do the driving, and I was in the passenger seat, she was sitting behind, and all the way from Heathrow to Bromley or somewhere in Kent, she never shut up giving instructions, turn left, don't go far, go to her. Just like the taxi driver similarly. She was an amazing backseat driver. I told her about it afterwards, she was very embarrassed, she said, "That's me," and she was honest about it. But you can't do that in meditation. You can't be a backseat driver. It's sort of like, let go, but then give some advice. Come on, do this and do that. You truly have to let go of your will for that nimitta to stay absolutely still. And it's worthwhile, because when the nimitta is still, it gets incredibly bright, brilliant. And the more bright and brilliant it becomes, the more bliss you have. And it's almost like the energy and the bliss always go together. Just like a metta going up the hill with Samatha and Vipassana. The higher you get, just the more metta just wags its tail. Some people experience that bliss as just real incredible love, because that's sometimes the only way they can describe that sort of energy. Bliss, ecstasy, just pure love, whatever it is. This is actually what you feel at the time, as your nimitta starts to stabilize. And when it really does stabilize and gets very bright, then actually you have the experience of nimitta is enveloping, you're falling into it, and you enter another stage where you're not experiencing a light, but you're experiencing just pure bliss, unmoving. When you go into those stages for the first time, haven't got a clue where you are, what's happening, but it's so nice and you can't do anything anyway, you stay in there for a while, and when you come out afterwards, people invariably say, "What the heck was that? That was beautiful, but what was it?" And always those times, that's, the jhana experiences. And you go to sort of a monk who has some experience, or a nun who has some experience, or go to the books, but the books, the teachings are there, but sometimes it really helps to have not just a book, which is just recording someone's experience, but someone who's actually been there can actually explain it more fully. And so what's actually happening there? You've gone into a jhana. You've gone even deeper into the mind. And what you've let go of this time is your will. The last bit of doing has disappeared. Which is why when people experience these things, on retreats such as this, or at home, and they come and tell me afterwards, it's amazing Just how many people, when I ask, well, what special thing did you do to get into those states? And so many people say exactly the same set of words. They say, they really let go. An important word, they really let go, fully, 100%. And I mention that because you've all been trying to let go, but you always keep something back. It's not 100% letting go. There's always a little bit of control in there. There's so just in case. You know, just keep your hand on one control, just in case. Because you can't really abandon your body and your will that easily. But every now and again, it does happen. Someone's just really let go. Let's go for it. 100%. And then because you let go 100%, it becomes the natural phenomena. When you let go, things disappear. That's what letting go means. Things vanish. The body vanishes, the will vanishes, and you go into these beautiful states of mind. And again, the fear, sort of may be afraid first of all, you know, may be afraid even when I talk about such things. But when you experience them, it's just so profound, so beautiful, so pure, you know, it can never be anything wrong. It may be similar to, I know that some of these evangelical Christians, they don't meditate because the devil may take over your mind. And they use fear. And sometimes people are afraid even to start meditating. When they start meditating, they do a little bit. It feels good. This can't be wrong. What I was afraid of? Meditating. It's not that bad. Sometimes people may be afraid of coming on a 9-day retreat with Ajahn Brahm. They have to get up early in the morning, have to sit all day. When you actually come here, you know, you can sleep as much as you want. It's nice and easy. So when you actually come here, you're not afraid anymore. So sometimes the experience of these things overcomes the fear. So much part of my job is almost like to trick you into experiencing these things. And so once you experience them, this is so beautiful, so profound, so lovely. What was I afraid of? And afterwards, not only your attachment to your body has been weakened, but your attachment to your will has been weakened. Attachment to what you think you are, yourself. When you realize letting go of will, fully, 100%, gives you so much peace, so much bliss, and it feels so pure, so wonderful. You won't be such a control freak ever again. You know you have to sort of drive your car because no one else is driving it when you go to work or when you're sort of at your home. I'm not talking about your physical, your real car, your body car. You know you have to, you know, work with this, but you realize, well, you know, I only have to do this, but I'm not really into it too much. And the first opportunity you have, you can let things go. Because you know, with that letting go, it gives a huge amount of peace and freedom. So these are ways we truly let go, which is a path of Buddhism. Many people talk about letting go, but they're not really letting go of the right thing. They're letting go of what's out there, but not what's inside, which is the important part of letting go. And they can't really let go of their body. And they can't let go of their will. And you know what happens when you get into these deep experiences? You think this will, this choice, which we cherish, we think is so important to us, actually is a torturer. Sometimes, you know, we think that we want to maintain our free will, our choice. We have rights so that we can always do whatever we want, whenever we want to. But when you've actually had a deep meditation, you realize this will was stopping you being peaceful. Never being satisfied, always telling you to go and get something more, something else. It never leaves you alone. It's the irritation. The Buddha actually called it, he had this great simile of the dog with mange. This mangy dog was in the village, and so was itching all over its body, so decided just to run off into the open air, thinking in the fields the mange would go away. But in the fields it was still itchy. So went under the shade of a tree, was still itchy, went into the water, was still itchy, went into a cave, was still itchy. Wherever it went, it could not get the mange away. It was always itchy. And you know what that itch is? You know how itchy the will is? Always having to scratch, get something, get rid of something. It never leaves you alone. Night and day. Wherever you go. But then someone gives you a medicine to get rid of the mange. And then wherever you are, you're at peace. You understand what we're talking about now? That will, that doer, is like the itch, which never leaves you alone. You know how hard it is to sit still and do nothing? Nothing to do in this retreat, is there? You don't have to cook. The food is going to come at 11 o'clock. You know it's going to come. You don't have to write letters, answer the phone, arrange anything. Everything's arranged for you. And these 9 days, you've got nothing to do, just about. So why can't we just let go and do nothing? Because we've got the itch. And that itch makes us, what am I going to do? Let's go and watch a tree. Let's go and have a cup of tea. I don't know, let's go and do some walking. No, I'm fed up with that. Let's go and have a sleep. No, I've slept too much already. Let's go and meditate. No, I can't do that either. As if the mind won't let you go. The will is always there, trying to exert itself. And it's the itch, which sometimes stays with us for all our life. But a few times you get these spaces where there's no itch at all. You're perfectly still, perfectly content, in deep meditation, no will at all. Wow, that is bliss. And you also get great insights from this. I'm not going to go into the deep insights and why these insights lead you to enlightenment yet, but I'm giving almost like a taste of this. And it is why that I mentioned last night, I cannot see how anyone can even become a stream winner without jhanas. I just can't see that. Although when I read the sutras, the texts, it does seem that people did get stream winning without the jhanas. But the texts of the Buddha are very clear. You can't become a non-returner or an arahat without jhanas. No more than you can get to the heartwood of a tree without going through the bark and the sapwood. And that's the Malunkyaputta Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, number 64. So if you can figure a way how to get to the heartwood of a tree without going through the bark and the sapwood, I'm sure you're trying to figure that out now. Now, Westerners are like that. They always think that they can be the first one to discover a way around the Buddha's teachings. So you have to go through that way. You have to go through the jhanas to abandon these attachments, because you need to see something much deeper than most people have seen. Have experience. Raw data which changes the way that you look at life. And that's why these jhanas are really important. And also, they're enormous fun. So that's why I market these jhanas on these retreats. And I don't care if you don't get them on this retreat. Because I'm suggesting this, because I'm marketing it, because I'm saying what happens, you let go of fear, because I'm pointing out the danger of excitement, there's more opportunity for you not to be excited, you know exactly what's going on. And one day you just press that letting go button and you go straight in. Don't think because you haven't got close so far, you're not going to get in the next meditation. It's nothing to do with how close you've got so far. Because sometimes people have been way, haven't even got a nimitta yet. They've hardly been able to watch the breath yet. But then suddenly they just do this, pressing the letting go button, that's all I can call it. Just a slightly different change of attitude. And they go far deeper meditation than they've ever had before. They even get into jhanas. They call it fluking it, but they did something, they deserved it. So sometimes it just comes when you're least expecting it. Those people who are getting nimittas every meditation, I must be close. Sometimes the person who's just managed to watch the breath for a few minutes gets it before they do. Which is why, having had those experiences as a teacher of meditation, I like to teach jhanas to everybody. And one day that will happen to you. And when it does, you know exactly what's happened and why and how it all fits in and why the Buddha said the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path is jhana, 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 jhana. Nothing else. And this is what you're doing. It's fun. So, that's a little talk this morning on nimittas and jhanas. Please don't try to get them. Remember, just be still, be peaceful, let go, and they will come to you. Don't press the flight attendant's button and say, jhana please. You get this big Soviet girl saying, yes! Okay, so any comments or questions on that talk so far?
Yes,
Yes.
Can a minister be both perceived as a light and as a warmth?
Can nimitta be perceived as a light and a warmth? Yeah, it can be perceived as many, many things. But the real good nimittas are when the body has completely disappeared and you can't hear anything, you can't feel anything. And what's left? So when all your five senses have been completely subdued, then what's left? And that has to be a nimitta. But it's more useful to even look for the light nimittas. Just looking for them, what I'm doing there by encouraging the light nimittas, I'm just literally getting into your head and changing the perception, so when those things go, you actually see the nimittas as lights. And they're far easier to work with than actually warmth or feely-feely nimittas.
But
you would know that if it's a real nimitta, it's different than the warmth you feel in the body. If you have some more experience, you see, well, it's like warmth, it's like pleasure, but this is not like a pleasure I've ever felt with the body before. Similar, but certainly not the same. Same as the lights. It's not a light which you can see in the world. You look at the colour of it. They don't have those colours in the world. They're just deeper and richer. That's why it's really good fun. Because you're having some nice weird experiences. And I love weird experiences. That's why I joined the Psychic Research Society when I was a student. Anything weird I was into. Yeah?
I mean, it's one thing if you're about to die and you know you don't need it again, but if you know you're going to need your body after you get out of meditation, it's like there's still that worry that, you know, what if I'm sitting in a bad position and then 2 hours later I'm going to have some injury?
Well, actually, I can guarantee that if you get into a jhana, when you come out afterwards, your body feels so nice. It's a weird thing that sometimes, you know, after, maybe I'm getting old now, maybe after an hour and a half or 2 hours, I start getting aches and pains. But if you get into a deep meditation, 4 hours, 5 hours, you get out afterwards, it's not an ache, not a pain. The body is just so light, you feel like you can run a marathon. So when you really get out of the way, your body just heals itself, no aches, no pains, and even sicknesses disappear. Fevers, malarias, and all that sort of stuff vanish. Because you've got a very powerful state of mind. Huge. So, yeah, those things actually do disappear. The experience I had when I was just 1 year as a monk, I got typhus fever. And at that time, we didn't realize what the fever was. Because according to the health department, there was no typhus fever in that part of Thailand. Later on, we found out that there was typhus fever there, but all the villagers were immune. It was only us Westerners coming from overseas didn't have that natural immunity. We got typhus fever. Eventually, found the mites, which give you the typhus fever. It's a fever just like typhoid. So you go into hospital there because a really heavy fever. It's quite dangerous. You need to be hydrated. You can't sort of hydrate in the monastery. So you had to have drips, and you had to have been injected. You know all those stories I have about those nurses in the northeast of Thailand, built like water buffalo, and she was, that's no exaggeration, that's a really big lady. And the only thing they did in those days was actually inject you with a cocktail of antibiotics, just hoping that one would work. But the problem was, that was 33 years ago, before they used disposable needles. All needles were recycled. So they were used in Bangkok, first of all. That's what I reckon, and that's probably true. And then they were sent up to the provinces, you know, cause especially the northeast, you know, the Thai people here, you know, the northeast are supposed to be, you know, the tough and stupid people. That's what they, well, I know, you're saying no, but that's how many people think. And so they're used up in the northeast, you know, for the northeast farming lands. And then last of all, used for the monks, especially the forest monks, because we are supposed to be the toughest of the tough. So, now these needles, they were really blunt. So they would never actually inject you. They would stab you. And again, no exaggeration, in the buttocks. In the morning, in the afternoon. And it was just like going to see the headmaster, getting the cane. It was just, my spine was so sore. then, you know, despite all of my compassion, no way could I be compassionate to that damn nurse. I hated her. And that was just, you know, just the injections, let alone the fever, which made you feel so weak. And, you know, it was these old wards, and they didn't even have bedpans. So you had to find your way to the toilet at the end of the ward. You know, maybe if you sort of knew somebody in the hospital, you can get the bed next to the toilet. That was, you know, the Rolls Royce of the beds. But it's literally that to go to the toilet was like a huge expedition to the North Pole. You know, you've managed to get up, and no one there to help you, to steady yourself and just lurch to the next bed and just hold on. And maybe another couple of minutes before you can make the journey to the next bed. And just hold on to the rails as you went. So when you got to the toilet, you spent at least an hour there to make sure you got everything out, because you didn't want to do that too many times in one day. So you felt really terrible and so weak. And I just remember just one day deciding, I just can't stand this any longer, and decided to meditate. Even though you had a fever and you felt just incredibly weak and sore, and just getting into a very nice deep meditation. And afterwards you felt so nice. It was the first break from the aches and pains and fevers for about 2 weeks. I don't know, because I was only a young monk now, but in retrospect I'm sure that was probably the time I started to get healthy again. Those sort of experiences, they break the fevers. Must be on the antibiotics. It would have been about that time. But, you know, I wasn't really sort of aware enough to see whether that was actually what broke the fever. But these meditations are very, very strong. And that's actually the time, what I did recognize, when I came out of my meditation, I looked at my posture. And the legs were all over the place, and one arm over here, one arm over there. And really, you know, you should have been in great pain with a posture like that for I don't know how long I was in meditation for. But you felt so good. What I realized there, the posture is not important for meditation. The posture I was in to get into that deep meditation was, I've never seen that in any meditation book, ever. You can get into deep meditation. So posture is not really important. It certainly is when you let go, you can actually heal things. So you don't have to worry at all. If you get into deep meditation, when you come out afterwards, your body will be better than ever. Any aches and pains, difficulties, even cancers will probably be in recession afterwards, I would say. Certainly aches and pains, no aches and pains. Okay, so no fear. Yes. Oh, good. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you can do. But you know, it's pretty much in context already. But the nice thing to do is actually re-experience that without dying. Because it's a pretty sort of dangerous thing having near-death experiences, because sometimes you don't come back. Yeah. Yeah.
And so, strangely, I thought ever since I've been reading about the diamonds, I'm thinking, oh, I bet I'm one of the people that doesn't have light.
Yeah.
And I never connected it to the universe.
Yep.
So now I'm nervous about, well, am I going to try and look for the light, or will it definitely not be a light, or...
No, that's the thing. Remember, in these cases... Very good. If it didn't have a light, that's fine. But if it's very peaceful and joyful, that's good enough to know. And a sense of freedom, the body disappearing, that's enough. It's enough to overcome your fear when the body starts to disappear in meditation. When things start to happen, you don't analyze. Just be still. Shh. You can take all the notes afterwards. Once when I was... After 1970, I decided to go on pilgrimage to India, to try and find as many holy sites as I could. I could only find two of them. Lumbini was the rose were washed out, and Kushinara I went to the tourist board. Where is it? They didn't know where it was. So it wasn't on any map, and I couldn't find it. So I gave that one up. So I did go up to Kathmandu, and we got this postal truck to go and visit the Tibetan border. And on the way, one of the reasons I wanted to go to Nepal especially was to see the Himalaya Mountains. You've seen pictures of them. They're majestic. They're a magnificent sight. So when I went up there, rainy season. There's clouds all over the place. There's no way I was going to see those Himalaya Mountains. I had a camera with me, and after the end I just gave up. But then one day, sort of, we were in the north of Nepal somewhere, and with this couple of Americans, and the postal truck we were riding in stopped for a cup of tea, and we didn't really want a cup of tea, but there's a nice little hill, so we climbed the hill. And at the top of the hill, it was amazing, the clouds parted, you could see the whole Himalaya Mountains, the whole range. I thought, wow, this is great. So I rushed down the hill to get my camera, which took about 5 minutes, and I ran up again as fast as I could, and just as I ran up, the clouds closed again. And these Americans say, where were you? That was an amazing sight. Because I tried to get my camera, I missed it. And that was actually a really great lesson for me. It's almost it was done on purpose. You know, let's open it up for Ajahn Brahm in the future. So he knows never to take a camera with him whenever he's having nice experiences. So you know what I mean by the camera, trying to take notes, trying to sort of remember it. When you get nimittas or these incredible experiences, don't try and collect those experiences and note them down. Leave them alone. You'll be able to remember them afterwards. Yeah, good. You couldn't. Yeah, it's very good. So it's nice not to have any will. Yeah, you can analyze it, it's in the past. But just see if you can have more and more experiences, because the more experiences you have, the more information you have, and the more you can understand exactly what's going on. And then you can also, this thing about will and being in control of things, it's just a waste of time. It creates so much problems in the world. So it's great to be able just to let go and just allow nature to happen. And you flow with things rather than always trying to swim your way. So especially in meditation. Shh. Let go. And then all the mange disappears. And you're free from this terrible itch. Okay, do you want to have a tummy chen quickly before we finish? Yes, good.
I think that is the best before you go to all these. But if you are doing the old method, I mean, not your method,
Old method, this is the old method.
I mean, before I know your method.
Okay, yeah.
I've been using the method, it's very quick and fast, you are in control.
Yeah.
But if you reach the mind experience, you realize that the mind, it's not you, the mind just will itself away, you have got caught by.
Yes, and tomorrow I will start talking about the second jhana, where there is really an amazing thing happens. And I will answer the question, or take your question even deeper. And that's coming tomorrow. Same time, same place. Don't miss it. Okay, that was a nice place to finish off, but nevertheless, Tanya, you are. okay, usually it happens by itself. Remember, whenever you're going through any sort of inside experiences, you have to be the passenger and just allow the whole thing to play out. So, you know, during the sort of the movie, sometimes there'll be some sad, some exciting points, but just wait till the end of where everything gets resolved. And remember, with the will thing, that's what happens in deep meditation. So when you come out of meditation, you have to do your duties in the world, and your duties motivates the will. So outside, please don't go and think that, you know, once you have a deep meditation, you don't have any will ever more, and you're just going around like a zombie. You know, but it's actually during the whole process, sort of a meditation, this is actually what happens, a very, very deep letting go. And it does actually sometimes get up some very old emotional stuff, but allow it to come up, because it's almost like a therapy, a catharsis. And you can sometimes feel like that story of like a bud. Just before a flower blooms, it's got this incredible tension inside of it. Just caught inside the envelope, just wanting to burst forth. And that's very, very unpleasant sometimes. If you can imagine what it's like to be a flower just before it blooms. I have a little bit of confidence there that after a little while, when the flower blooms, oh, it's so nice and so free. So bear with it for a while, because it gets better.